From WXXI News, this is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Our connection this hour was made in 1999 when a new book made a bold prediction. The co-authors were an economist and a syndicated columnist, and they concluded that stocks were cheap and most Americans were missing out on a big opportunity. The title of their book was straightforward, Dow 36,000, the new strategy for profiting from the coming rise in the stock market. The Dow at the time, 1999, was around 10,000 when the book was published. The authors declared that it would more than triple in the next 3 to 5 years. A decade later, they had to concede that they had lost the bet, that they had been wrong. The book is sort of in the Jim Cramer bin of irrational, loud, headline-grabbing predictions. But here's where the authors were right, in a way. The market has withstood all kinds of tumult. And in 2021, it finally did crack 36,000. It dipped back down, but this past Friday, the Dow once again crossed 36,000. November was the best month of the year for the markets, but that hasn't stopped a wave of headlines trying to explain why the economy is actually bad and that workers are actually miserable. And Republicans hate the economy because of Democrats in the White House, and Democrats hate the economy because progressive policy gains haven't been progressive enough for their taste, so no one seems happy. And journalist and author Derek Thompson says that's baloney. He writes that the persistent employment misery is a myth. In a new piece, Thompson writes, quote, "The typical career is about 80,000 hours long, or one-sixth of the average person's waking life. One would love to be deliriously happy for all 80,000 hours, but alas, we're not. And the economic news industry loves nothing more than to remind us of it. In fact, for the past 3 years, finance media have become so desperate to explain the state of workplace misery to their audience that they've often ignored facts, logic, or basic common sense," end quote. So what's he talking about? How should we contextualize the economy? Thompson writes, quote, "In 2021, finance journalism couldn't stop talking about the so-called Great Resignation. Judging by the ample coverage, it appeared that workers everywhere were smashing their laptops and machines in a bacchanal of joblessness. This was all hooey. In reality, more Americans were just breaking up with their old employers to get higher-paying jobs. In professional sports, when star athletes sign larger contracts with different teams in the offseason, ESPN doesn't call it a Great Resignation. It's called free agency. And that's what the economy's Great Resignation really was, a welcome free agent period for low-income workers looking for higher wages," end quote. Gas prices are down around 20 cents from a year ago. Inflation has slowed, although I confess I never know quite how to contextualize inflation. Certainly some prices are pretty sticky and pretty high. I'm looking at you, Eastview Mall cookie that my son loves, which was now $5 we found out last week. So let's ask the experts for some of their ideas on where we are with the economy. Chuck Wade is Senior Vice President of Brighton Securities. Welcome back to the program,
Thank you for having me.
And Dr. Eric Morris is here. Eric is Staff Economist for Alesco Advisors. Welcome back, sir.
Thanks, Evan. Happy to be here.
Last time we talked inflation, it was an Abbott ice cream.
It was an Abbott. I was going to mention that Abbott.
The same
now we're going
price,
to cookie.
Right?
It sounds like a Sweet Tooth family
it
over
is.
There.
It's for sure a Sweet Tooth family. But we go to Eastview, and he loves the cookie place there. And I was like, $5? That's a pretty sticky high price. Is that an example of a sticky price there?
Well, who knows how sticky it would be, but that is a high price as far as I'm concerned. That better be a large and tasty
cookie. It was pretty
cookie.
Big. It was pretty big, yeah, but it was like $3 the last time.
Yeah, that's quite a price increase.
That's a big one.
Yeah.
So a lot to talk about here, and I do want to ask both of you. I'll start with you, Chuck. Do you agree that we are sort of addicted to bad news or the worst possible prognostications or analysis as opposed to kind of sober, even-keeled analysis?
Yeah, and I mean, the thing is that if it was sober, even-keeled analysis and just a very, you know, boring headline, not many people would click on it or want to read it. And the other thing that you said that I get a kick out of when you mentioned the Great Resignation is we are obsessed, I think, as a society with naming things and giving everything a name. The Great Resignation and all of these things, and then what that does is it just kind of funnels down into people developing thoughts and developing impressions based on what they're seeing somewhere else and not really having a lot of context or actual valid data to make well-informed decisions that they can then act on.
Thompson says, here's another, quiet quitting. He's like,
same thing, yeah.
We have to name something. And I don't want to push back on that so much as I want to say that I do think there's times where a clever turn of phrase can be useful in identifying some ways in which the culture may be changing.
Mm-hmm.
And the culture is changing generation to generation, as it always does when it comes to expectations that workers have, how they describe their goals, what a work life looks like, of course that's going to see some change. But quiet quitting, Thompson identifies in the category that you're describing, which is we just made up a name for something that has always kind of happened, which is that sometimes some small number of workers, when they're not happy, they kind of start doing the minimum or they burn out. And like that's not necessarily new.
No, and I think what ends up happening is naming things is an easy way to take a lot of different perspectives and data and things that are happening and help simplify and give them a way that people can understand them. Like you said, quiet quitting is a lot of people maybe choosing to do less or being dissatisfied with income or work-life balance and all of these things. And so quiet quitting is just how we explain it so that we can understand it. And then we can have something to talk about without having to take 20 minutes to explain ourselves.
And that's probably fair. And listeners, by the way, if you want to weigh in as we talk this hour about the state of the economy, is it working for you? How is it? You have questions, comments about the state of things? I try to be as humble as I can. That's why the experts are here. And we are going to talk about inflation, where we are with that. We're going to talk about where we see the markets right now, if 36,000 means anything, where it goes next exactly for the next 12 months so you can make every possible perfect investment. Mm. That's not what we're going to do. But you can call toll-free 844-295-TALK. It's 844-295-8255. 263-WXXI if you're in Rochester, 263-9994. You can email the program connections at WXXI.org. Eric, do you think that we have a tendency to gear towards the negative and the bombastic?
Yes, and I think that it's I think that it's partially human nature. It's in ourselves,
right.
And I think that something Chuck brought up, talking about the naming of events, actually pairs really well with this idea of the pessimism and latching onto that. And there is just a large demand, and there has always been for the peddling of pessimism in human society. Partially we've evolved in this way to be super hyper-tuned for pessimism because it helps us in terms of creating our own defenses.
And sure,
that's something to
right?
think about. Yeah. But also from a psychological standpoint, something that humans struggle with, and this is me putting on my behavioral economist hat here, but something that humans struggle with is uncertainty and change. And when we struggle with that, rather than accepting it, we seek solutions. And pessimism, when it comes to explaining uncertainty and change, sounds authoritative. It sounds like it is an explanation for something, and it holds this air of authority about it, as too does a phrase like the Great Resignation sound authoritative. And what that does for us is that even the most informed and wisest and intelligent of us can only possibly know like a fraction of a percent of the entire world. That's a daunting thing. But what we can do is we can take these mental models that are given to us through, say, a phrase like the Great Resignation or through some wild pessimism, apply that mental model to our own view of the world and say, I have a little more understanding of how this works. And that's false. It's a false comfort, but it is human nature to process in that way, for better or for worse.
I think it's really important to key in on the point that there is something valuable for looking for trouble, looking for signs of trouble. And it's absolutely a survivability instinct. I mean, animals in the wild do it. Human beings have evolved to do it. If your life depends on it, you have to be able to do it. That's not the same, and I know our guests are making this distinction too, with overhyping everything into the worst possible way. And some of that's political, and our guests are, we're not wading through politics, but just the reality being less than a year now to a big election, there's going to be an information war in which the political right's going to try to convince you that the economy's terrible, even if it looks better. And the left will try. Well, I don't even know if the left is even trying anymore. I think like that's the funny thing about this is the left sort of hates the economy for different reasons than the right. But this always happens. Whoever's in the White House, the other side's going to tell you it's terrible, no matter what the indicators are. And Eric and I talked about that the last time we was on. That's human psychology too. I don't want to make this too political, other than to say I'm worried about one thing in particular here, and I want to ask both of you about this. I think it's good to be careful and looking for the signs on the horizon that things could be bad or dangerous or trouble to your portfolio, trouble to your life, trouble to your employment. Absolutely. I think there's a whole other level of problem when there's an industry created to convince you that everything's the worst it's ever been. that this is the worst it's ever been to be alive in human history. It's never been worse. Never been worse. And there's so many reasons to think that's not the case. But I think the more, to speak of psychology and sort of the behavioral economists, the more people believe that, the worse things can get collectively in different ways. And that is what worries me. What do you think, Eric?
Yeah, I mean, what people are trying to do there is create a sense of urgency, because urgency creates action, and action in a market, something like that. I mean, you could make it seem urgent in a lot of different areas. You could think of even like the cosmetics industry and saying, like, you know, you got to treat your wrinkles now, right? And you don't want to wind up old and shriveled, and they make that look so terrible, and they jump on that, you create the sense of urgency. And then when you have a whole industry that is pumping and negativity and that type of urgency in there as well, it does create a herd effect. We are social animals. And so when we see this type of uncertainty grip others, we have trouble grappling with it ourselves.
Yeah. And I think, Chuck, that when we are acting on that urgency with accurate information, then we can do important things. When we are acting urgently and sort of wildly on stuff that is mostly not true, then I worry. That's what worries me.
Yeah, and we live in a world where it's so easy to get a view of what life is like or what other people are doing and how grandiose it is, but nobody's really sharing the other side of that. And I'm referring to social media and that, because
how often do we
see, you know, you see this image, this curated image of you know, what life is like. You just had a baby, all right? He's got a 2-month-old son.
Tommy Morris at home.
You know, and I think back to, like,
congratulations.
Thank you. Hi, Tommy.
Awesome side of that. And there's a lot of it. There's also the side where you're exhausted, and, you know, you're not really thinking straight at times throughout the day because you're so tired, and the challenges of having a newborn. We keep the challenging side off of social media. We don't show that part of our lives very often. But what then we see as a society is we say, oh, well, I should be doing this because this person's doing it. I should be doing this because this person is doing it. And often I think what we end up doing is losing sight of what's most important to ourselves as values and things that drive us personally. And that's where I think we can get into this. There's so many things we think we need to be doing because what we see others doing and what we see others putting out there. Does that make sense?
Absolutely, yeah. And that's one of the things that Chuck has talked about on this program in the past. When we kind of take a look at where the markets are, is it's valuable to ask, this is not a one-size-fits-all, just as you wouldn't work with clients in a one-size-fits-all way. Mm-hmm. Eric wouldn't. I mean, that's people who are closer to retirement might feel differently than someone who's in a long-term. Or if there is a lot of tumult and a downturn, people who are closer to retirement might feel less inclined to sort of hang tight for a while, taking a longer view. So there's a lot of different reasons, I think, to approach things with some nuance. And let's kind of walk through some of the market. So here we are with, I think, the best month of the year. Had a big rally on Friday. Crossed 36,000 again. Do we care about 36,000 anymore, Chuck? Does that number mean anything? I don't know.
I don't pay a ton of attention to, like, the specific number, because it's kind of a bogey along the way. And I think the thing with the Dow Jones Industrial Average, which is what you're referring to, hitting 36,000, is that's an index of, it's an average of 30 companies. And so it's also not the truest measure of how the stock market or how the economy is doing, because if one of those 30 companies is either having a great day or a not so great day, it's going to move that average, it'll move that along. But it's the easiest index for us to look at and say, oh, the Dow was up 100 points today. That was a good day. If we say the S&P 500 was up 10 points, do you know if that's good, bad, average? It's just, I think it's easier for us to conceptualize how things did because of what we see the Dow doing, but it's not the best measure, in my opinion, of the stock market or the economy, because it's only 30 companies.
And I think it's important to remember, too, that markets don't move in a straight line. So we hear these day-to-day updates, and, you know, it's something that people are interested in, but markets don't move in straight lines. And so over time, we have to think about what's the net effect of that, and how, you know, what the longer term trends are. I understand that the people who have shorter time horizons, you know, you guys were just mentioning that you've talked about this in the past, people with more immediate needs in terms of financially, they are thinking more in short term. So that each day that goes by is a little bit more important than somebody who has a longer term investment horizon. But at the same time, though, a day is just a day. And so markets don't move in straight lines.
So what do you look for? Because on NPR's reporting, you'll hear, you know, the Dow Jones is off, blah, blah, blah. And, you know, the NASDAQ is...
Well,
what are you looking
to, for? To Chuck's point, there are a lot of different measures of how stocks perform, and they are grouped into indices in different ways. There's the Dow Jones Industrial Average. There's the S&P 500, which is the 500 largest companies in the stock market, with some tweaks as to who gets to get into that and who doesn't. There's the Russell 2000, which is small companies that are out there. So you can look at these indices. It's important to understand what they're telling you, right? Which you and I have had this conversation before about economic data. It's important to really understand what it's telling you and not put too much stock in an indicator in that way. And I think the big distinction that we have to hit here, I think especially for our listeners, is that no matter how these stock indices are doing, the stock market is not the economy. So the stock market is not the economy. The economy is a very, very, very broad machine that is how we buy, sell, make, and use goods and services across the board. The stock market represents a portion of the economy, and it represents the value of the ownership of a share in the companies that are that portion of the economy. So it is possible for the economy to be doing well, and I say that maybe with my air quotes here that you can't see as you're listening to us, but doing well in the stock market to be going down. And it's possible for the opposite to happen as well. And that's because what drives stocks is partially the economy, but it's also a whole bunch of other things that go into determining the price of a stock. Same thing is those companies that are publicly traded that you can buy and sell ownership in and with stock, they are a part of the economy, but they're not everything in the economy. So other things could be impacting that as well.
Can I add to that?
Yeah.
Because I think something that is, we've talked about this with a lot of clients, is that the stock market's a forward-looking instrument. Oftentimes when we get economic data or information, that's what's happened a month ago or what is happening today. And I think as people, we often kind of look in the rear view. Well, this is what my accounts were worth a year and a half ago when they hit the high point. And so I'm gonna evaluate how it's doing today based on what it was a year and a half ago. But when news comes out or data comes out, the stock market is projecting, what does this mean 3, 6, 9, 12 months from now? And you'll see that reflected in the performance on any given day. Is there's news being digested, but the stock market's reacting proactively to it. And we often react or are reactive in terms of this has happened and now I'm going to make my decision based on it. And so I think that is an important distinction to make.
And to piggyback off of Chuck's point as well, he talks about the stock market being forward-looking. It's not the stock market itself, which I know exactly what Chuck's saying. It's the stock market. All we talk about it like it's some big ambiguous thing that, like, you know, has a brain of its own and a mind of its own, and some people might like to think of it that way, but all that is the people who are buying and selling the stocks. It's individual decisions. The stock market's movement on any given day is the summation of hundreds of thousands, if not millions, of individual different decisions that have been made and how they all sum total at the end. And so when we talk about the stock market being forward-looking, it's individuals who are participating in the stock market applying their forward-looking thoughts, their interpretation to this data. And Evan, we have had conversation after conversation about the accuracy or the quality of forward-looking predictions or projections.
But to Chuck's point, though, it is interesting to think about this way. And tell me if I'm going to put my student hat on, and I want you to tell me how I'm doing here. So I'm going to compare the stock market. I'm trying not to do this writ large, but
sure,
it's clumsy, to Major League Baseball free agency. Major League Baseball free agency doesn't happen until a player has 7 years of service time, the most of any professional sport. So by the time a player is getting a huge contract, they have had a chance to establish themselves as a star, but they might actually be past their physical prime. In baseball, your physical prime is age 27. So you might get a contract 31. You sign a 10-year contract at 31, a 13-year contract, Xander Bogaerts, there are some people doing some malpractice. But anyway, that's a whole other thing. The contract is supposed to be paying a player for what they'll be able to contribute, when in reality, the length of these contracts now are paying for past performance. Mm-hmm. They're hoping that the first few years, maybe, are going to reflect the past performance. But the back end of these... that is, nobody really believes that you're paying $40 million a year when a guy's 39 because they're going to be producing at a high level. You're paying for past performance. What the stock market is supposed to be doing is, the reason the stock's going up is not because, well, this company had a good year. It's because there are indicators that it is going to be hot, that it's that it is in the right place, that whether it's biotech, whatever it is, that is primed to do well, and so therefore people are willing to sort of make a bet that it is on the upswing, that we're not just paying for past performance, we're looking forward. Is that roughly correct?
Yeah, I think you are. And I was thinking of that specific example this morning, thinking about, oh, you know, what might we talk about? Or how do you explain the stock market being forward-looking? And all right, so I'm a Bills fan, and thinking it is very often similar to your team signs a player in the offseason or moves that are made in the offseason and how we as fans interpret, okay, well, the Bills just signed XYZ player. They will therefore be better now because of what just happened. You can look at a company and say, well, the economy just announced that, you know, we just got this piece of data that inflation may be, you know, maybe hitting its peak. Well, what does that mean for Procter & Gamble? What does that mean for Apple? What does that mean for NVIDIA? So it is very similar in that we get a piece of information and then we project out what that means.
Okay.
I think it's a pretty good analogy.
It's part of the explanation for sure. You know, when we think about a hot streak and that continuing, but there are also, and I think that applies more to certain components of the market than other components. I think that applies to, Chuck, you mentioned NVIDIA, right? Mm-hmm. This is maybe no hotter stock the past year, 18 months or 2 years than NVIDIA. And that hotness piece might help explain some of the irrational exuberance that has been driving the rapid growth of this stock price. But there are also, you know, in the Russell 3000, there are 2,999 other companies. Well, really, there's six others in this Magnificent Seven, which would be fun to talk about if we want to there. but maybe, so 2,993 other companies that don't have this same hotness appeal, yet their stock prices still fluctuate. And a large part of that is from not just the speculative nature of thinking that I could be able to sell this stock at a higher price than it would be if I bought it today, but it could also be the discounted cash flows of future profits. You know, that's sort of your textbook answer about stock pricing, which we know doesn't always hold up, because when we think about how we discount future profits, people are factoring in all sorts of things like, what's AI's impact going to be on Facebook or Meta, I suppose? You know, what is the impact of the war in Russia and Ukraine going to be having on you know ExxonMobil, you know, something like that? But we process these things imperfectly, but there are certain things that we do expect in terms of profits. It's not just all about, you know, Chuck, we talked initially before we came out, it's not all just about Bitcoin or crypto, where you're just simply buying and selling things that have no value whatsoever. Your ownership in a corporation does have more value than that. So it's not all about what's hot or what's going to cool off. I think that sort of oversimplifies it a little bit.
Okay. So a couple of things from listeners here. I want to get an email from Andrew and then Andy, two different people.
Oh.
Andrew first. Andrew's asking for how our guests would define a correction and if we are due for a correction. So in a sense, this is asking them to predict what the market is going to do next. So is this a trap question?
Let me comment on the due for. And I think, Evan, I've used this analogy before, but we talk about flipping a coin. And I'll give you one chance to bet on a coin flip, and I'm going to flip the coin five times. You bet on the fifth, right? And I flip it the first time, and I get heads. Then I flip it the second time, tails. Third time, tails. Fourth time, tails. What are you going to pick?
Well, the average person would say heads, but
heads,
the dice has no
you're
memory.
Due, right?
The coin has
and
no
I don't
memory.
Want to simplify the stocks to betting on a coin flip. But when you think about whether you're due for a correction or not, I think that's really this idea of this hot hand bias, right? If things have been going too long, they have to be corrected. Well, maybe. There's an old saying among economists that says that anything that can't last forever won't last forever. But that doesn't mean that there has to be some sort of rapid downfall. There has to be some sort of rapid increase after a downfall. It comes back to this idea that markets don't go in straight lines, and that over the long term there has been a nice trend.
Okay, let me jump here, because part of what he's asking for is an actual definition of a correction.
Sure.
So go ahead.
So I think that would be valuable. I also want to say, to Eric's point, I'm guessing two things can be true at once, which is it can't last forever. What's the phrase?
Things that can't last forever won't.
Okay.
Yeah.
That can be true while also saying it's impossible to predict when that won't last for.
100%.
You know, I mean, like,
if there was to be something that I would 100% bet my life on, it would be that it's impossible to predict when that will happen. Yes.
When a pullback or correction.
Absolutely.
So how do you define correction, Chuck?
I mean, I think the definition is it a drop of 10%?
10%.
Within a certain period of time? Here's the reality. We're always heading towards the next correction. We're always heading towards the next recession. The question is when. And that's what when someone's like, oh, I think we're heading to a recession, say, okay, when? We will at some point, you know, and if you're someone who's in your 50s, you know what? I hope you have, I mean, we had a correction a lot more frequently than people realize we do. But if you're in your 50s, you know, I hope you've got 7 or 8 more really significant economic events in your life, because that means you're going to live a lot longer. They're just part of the normal cycle. And so I think we have to often think of how do we think about it, too, is that, yeah, we're absolutely due for a correction because we're going to hit one at some point. That could be 6 months, 2 years. You know, corrections actually happen a lot more frequently than we realize.
So is it fair then to say that you're someone who believes in a, you know, a calm, long-term approach, knowing that inevitably there will be corrections or pullbacks, that there will be gains, and hopefully over time the gains are increasing and outweigh the pullbacks and the corrections. But you're also not going to say, well, we hit 36,000, so that, or if we hit 40, then we pull out. Like, that's just not what you think
no,
is wise.
No, I don't. And because part of that is that I think it's really important in our business, this is a relationship business, is that we're setting expectations realistically ahead of time. And it's a lot different if we say, look, we're going to hit some rough patches along the way. We absolutely are. And here's what you can expect when we hit one of those. You know, here's what you can expect, not in terms of how the market's going to perform, but how we'll address it.
Yeah, that's another important point, though, Chuck brings up, is that even when we do think about how, you know, there has been this pattern of recessions that happen in the economy, it's really been impossible to predict how the markets have reacted to recessions. Obviously, markets don't like recessions. But if you look back at the past 3 recessions that we've had, COVID recession in 2020, the Great Financial Crisis recession that was really 2008, and then the dot-com recession that hit in 2001, the stock market, you look at the S&P 500, it performed differently in terms of timing around all 3 of those events. Sometimes the stock market actually went down before the actual recession hit. So there's to Chuck's forward-looking point. They started to see some data points in the markets, and so buyers and sellers of stocks started to behave in a way that the prices went down. And then in some cases, it actually went down well after the peak of unemployment hit, which would be sort of like, you know, peak recession, and the length of recovery varies too, just like it does in the economy. So there's a lot of uncertainty. You know, Charlie Munger, who just passed away last week, is Warren Buffett's investment partner, you know, arguably the second most successful investor of all time, although Buffett wouldn't like him being referred to himself as the best investor without Charlie being at his side. But Charlie Munger said that, look, you know, investments are one of these things that you have to be prepared to see the value of your investments go down. And he said 50% every once in a while. Now, that's drastic.
50.
Now, this was not a prognostication.
That's a depression, isn't it?
No, this is not a prognostication, him saying that this is going to happen. But he said you should be prepared. You should be prepared for that in other parts of your life. You should be earning an income, and you should be having enough saved that you could withstand something like that. And this is him just saying, you know, if you have risked so much in different ways and aspects of your life that you couldn't withstand that happening, for, you know, holding on to your investments during that time while this correction, because that's the nature of a correction, right? It's gonna come back, right? It's gonna things are going to resume. While that works out, if you can't handle that, he said you probably shouldn't be putting so much in the market because it is fickle. But over longer terms of time, over longer periods of time, there is a trend that markets tend to grow.
Yeah. So Chuck, if you've got a client who says a 10% correction would kill me, there's something wrong, right?
Yeah, then we need to have a different conversation. But the reality is, like Eric said, we can't predict the severity of when something's going to go down or when it's going to happen. But what we can really, really, really accurately predict is how we as human beings are going to act when it happens. And so that, I think, is the more important part of the conversation, is acknowledging, look, this is going to happen at some point. I hope it happens many times throughout the course of our relationship. And then we chuckle and laugh, but it's saying, you know what? What our objective here is to do the average thing while the rest of the world around us is going crazy. And what history has shown time and time and time again is those that can do the average thing, just kind of ride it out, when everyone else around them is going crazy, are the ones that are most rewarded over the long period of time. And even Warren Buffett and Charlie Munger, very smart people. They're incredibly patient people. They're two of the most patient investors. But that has translated to excellent returns and significant wealth creation over time.
I'm going to get Andy's question on the other side of this break.
Right, Andy.
So Andrew, thank you for the question on corrections. Andy, I'll take your email next. Some questions as well on inflation, which we'll hit in our second half hour. So let's take our only break of the hour. We'll come back with Chuck Wade, Senior Vice President of Brighton Securities, Eric Morris, who's staff economist for Alesco Advisors. We're right back with them next. I'm Evan Dawson, Tuesday on the next Connections. Organizations working to help the most vulnerable in our area. Just Cause, Law New York, the Empire Justice Center, Legal Aid, all under one roof now. What do they do? Who can they help? They'll explain on Tuesday. In our second hour, City Magazine, a new issue to explore with the editor and the crew from City. This is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Andy says, Evan, I feel our perception of the economy could be a reflection of the increased polarization of everything in life right now. You're either left or you're right. You're either pro-choice or pro-life. We're set up to right now see things as either good or bad, no in between. So if we're not at the level of a Bezos or a Musk, then the economy must be leaving us behind. There is some truth to that, knowing that our buying power is less than in past decades. But people generally are more comfortable now than in the past. And maybe buying power and being able to have stuff shouldn't be the measure of a successful life. Money ain't everything. That's from Andy. So there's a lot there. And I think our guests have largely agreed with the fact that that things do get polarized, and perception is not always reality. That's fair. But Andy's also bringing up buying power, which relates to, you know, just inflation and how far your money goes. So I've got a couple of emails on this, and we'll just roll them into this one here. So let's talk inflation. And you know what? Maybe even before we get into inflation, I'm going to make one other observation. Eric, I noted that when you talked about the recent recessions, you didn't mention the recession of 2023 or 2022. Does this mean that we are officially past the point now and we dodged that recession? No recession, won't be a recession.
It'd be really hard to
say. And
how
annoying is this question?
I love it because I'm being asked. And when I stop getting asked this question, I'll have to retire.
Okay. All right. All right.
It would be really hard, given the data that just came out about the third quarter of 2023, which wrapped up on September 30th. It'd be really, really hard for the third quarter of 2023 to be considered part of a recession. The official measurement of the health and growth of our economy, it's a single measure that doesn't talk about everything that's going on in the economy, but the speed at which the economy is growing, it was real GDP, grew at a 5.2% annual rate, which is very high. It was initially published at 4.9%, and it takes the number crunchers and the bean counters a little bit of time to actually go back and say, is there anything we learned? Is there anything we can tweak a couple months later? And they tweaked it from 4.9 up to 5.2%. That is far from a recession. It's nowhere close. A lot of projection models right now have the economy continue to grow in positive territory for quarter four, but you know how we both feel about projections. It'd be really hard to say, though, that third quarter be part of a recession. Whether or not the economy enters one in the fourth quarter of 2023, first quarter of 2024, second quarter of 2027, it will be hard to say. It's often impossible to know when we're in a recession until it's already happened.
Because we're analyzing previous data to determine whether we're in one. So by the time we're in one, it's already happened.
Okay. So, but we didn't go through one this year anyway.
I am going to wait until the year's over to make that call because we have, what is today, December 9th? No, what is it, 5th?
It's the 4th.
Fourth? It's the 4th, I believe.
Oh, boy, I just had a baby. So
I know, you really
time,
did.
Time
baby
has,
brain,
yeah,
man.
I've got no
We all know it's Monday.
I didn't miss Christmas, did I?
Yeah, it's February 8th.
Thank you.
Have you had a good winter? Okay, so you're going to wait, but then the separate question is, we haven't had one so far. We haven't gone through one so far,
right,
far as we know.
Right.
No.
Okay.
No, but that's different too. Like than what you said, everything's more expensive still, and because of metrics that are being used
to
measure inflation.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, everyone feels that, and so that is still something that is an issue.
So when Andy says, you know, talks about buying power, et cetera, and there's a lot of debate about is inflation, is it over? Is it slowed? Is it, you know, what's happening to prices? One of the things that Eric and I talked about maybe a year ago here was when inflation happens, some goods and services have stickier prices than others.
That's right.
And so we're feeling that in a lot of ways, whether it is the $5 cookie or at the grocery store, certain prices you all notice are up and they haven't come down and they haven't pulled back. And then maybe in other places they will a little. But let's start with price stickiness. We'll talk about, then I want to talk about buying power and what that sort of means for us right now. So Chuck, a little overview. What are you seeing in terms of buying power and stickiness?
Yeah, I mean, go out to eat. That's become significantly more expensive. So in a lot of areas that now are hitting us in our day-to-day lives, Christmas trees are more expensive. I mean, everything is more expensive. But while all of this is happening, travel and people taking trips, vacations, experiences, we're back finally to pre-pandemic level highs. And so even though things have gotten more expensive, I think what's happened in a lot of ways, we're buying less stuff. But as a whole, people seem to be wanting to spend more money on experiences and getting back out and doing things that were kind of taken away for a while. But in terms of buying power, we've seen inflation has risen pretty significantly, and it's certainly taken a toll on people's wallets, and add to the fact that student loan repayments began not too long ago. And so, yeah, there has certainly been a reduction in most people's purchasing power.
And to your point about where all those prices, whether it is different payments, the grocery store, trips, et cetera, I think, and there's an economist in the room, we'll get his take in a second. This is where I think this is a lay opinion. This is an observation. This is where I think the Paul Krugmans of the world fall a little short. Krugman has been, you know, beating this drum that inflation is not a problem really anymore, like that it has pulled back so much. Instead of saying, okay, we went through a very rough inflationary period, and how sticky has everything been, and how much are people still feeling that? The average person is not looking at the percentage of inflation month to month, quarter to quarter, year to year. They're going, what does it cost to go out? What does it cost to go to the grocery store? What does it cost to fix up something on my house? Mm-hmm. And so my sense, Chuck, is that it's still tight right now. It's tough.
Yeah, and it's also something that is very situational, I think. If you're someone who is actively looking to purchase a home right now, then you probably have a very different view of what inflation is, as I'm making air quotes, than somebody who refinanced their home in late 2020 and has a mortgage below 3% or at 3%. And so I think you have to also think it can be very situational based on where people are in their lives, in terms of how they're feeling the pinch of inflation.
Mm-hmm. Eric?
I don't always defend Paul Krugman, but I'm going to defend him here with my...
That's why I said I'm the layperson.
With my economist hat on. And this is one of the troubles with economics, I should say with economists, is that the study, part of its study is macroeconomics, which is really all we've been talking about here. And macroeconomics is all about aggregates. And we've had this discussion before where we lump together all of the experiences of people into averages.
Sure.
Into one big index. And when Paul Krugman talks about the fact that inflation is now slowing to a pace that's more toward normal levels, he's saying, yeah, this isn't as much of a policy issue anymore. We don't need to be handling it as aggressively. What that makes people who hear that feel like that makes them feel like he's discounting their personal experience. Like Chuck says, with, you know, they might have bought a home at a higher interest rate, and so now the higher prices that they're paying at the grocery store are getting eaten into by that higher interest rate, you know, having to float that mortgage payment. They're trying to put this all together. That's really difficult. They're a single person in this 320 million person economy that Paul Krugman is saying, yes, prices are now growing at a more acceptable level for people. So Paul Krugman is right, and maybe the person who's being squeezed by inflation is right, but they're coming at this from different angles. And really, when economists talk like that, they're talking about aggregates. I'm going to commit the faux pas right here and add a little context to this and say the fact that as inflation has continued to grow at a rate that's higher than we'd like to see, but that has slowed down its pace of growth, right? Because this is like driving a car, right? Prices aren't going to go down, right? They're slowing their growth. So it's like hitting the brakes on a car. The car's still going forward. It's just not going as fast as it was, right? So price growth is slowing down. Wage growth has been up. On the whole, on average, the past couple quarters, workers' pay rates have been going up higher than the price of the goods and services the people buy. On the whole, this creates a lot of, you know, it opens up the door for a lot of different mismatches to occur. It's not the experience of every single person out there. I'm sure there's people listening right now that are saying, absolutely not. I haven't gotten a pay raise. Where's my pay raise? Right. But there are also other people out there who have gotten pay raises and they are paying higher prices, but the increase in their pay is covering the higher prices, which is part of the reason why we see consumers continuing to spend. Consumer spending, part of the reason we're not in a recession right now, and probably the main reason we're not in recession right now, is that consumers who make up 2/3 of the economy through their spending have not dropped off their spending. They continue to spend, accounting for inflation. So this is accounting for those price increases. It's not just like, oh man, I have to pay more for gas, so I'm going to buy the same amount monetarily, but I'm going to buy fewer gallons. No, this is talking about the fact that they are continuing, accounting for inflation, to continue to spend. So people are spending, people are earning, people are working, prices are higher, and that's not comfortable. But on the whole, when you average all of this out, again, to be the Paul Krugman here, might sound insensitive.
No, this is
but to average this all out, useful. The economy is, by the data we're looking at right now, in a pretty good place. You know, that doesn't mean like it might not be next week or the week after.
I hear that.
But by the picture that data tells us is that the economy on the whole, averaged out, is in a pretty good place.
And just one other question, consumer spending.
Yeah.
If consumer spending remains strong, I guess what I want to know is, does consumer spending, is that an indicator that isn't really hypeable, that isn't twistable with, you know, propaganda? In other words, if consumers are spending, it's because they're not as pinched as people are hyping them to be. Or could consumers spend through?
You could hype consumer spending. It happened this summer when everyone talking about the, you know, Taylor Swiftonomics. Right? I mean, that really.
If anybody can afford to go to a Taylor Swift concert, anyways, you got daughters.
That was hyping consumer spending. No, I mean, but there's been some interesting shifts in consumer spending. Like older adults now make up a far higher percentage of consumer spending than they did before. Right? That's actually a really interesting data point for economists to look at. Right? That doesn't get talked about in the news. It's a shame, but it doesn't get talked about in the news. Okay.
But consumer spending is helpful as a tool to at least understand how it.
Absolutely. A primary tool.
Okay. Yeah. And by the way, please don't email me and say, Evan, boys can go to Taylor Swift as well. I just looked at Chuck because Chuck's got daughters. That's all. I don't even know if they're Taylor Swift.
Yeah, we're going to a Taylor Swift tribute in a couple of years. That was a more palatable price point. And we didn't win any of the lotteries. We didn't win any of the lotteries anyway. So
that's all.
We didn't
that's
get
the only
chance.
Reason I did that. That's the only reason. I did not want to get in trouble. The phone's ringing right now. Someone's going to yell at me. So now let me take this in a couple of other directions, because listeners are also asking about, there's a lot of stuff about, like, you know, what happens next year. We're not going to do too much of that. Our guests are not here to predict the economy. So if I'm skipping that and you've emailed about that, that's not the purpose. We appreciate their expertise, but no one is going to sit here and tell you that the Dow or the market or your portfolio is going to do anything in the next 12 months. This is where Jerome says, James says, why is no one talking about what inflation has been like around the world? I have friends in Europe. Inflation is terrible there too. Okay. Mm-hmm. So James is making an important point here. And this is what drives me nuts about American political sort of culture. People are saying, well, inflation's been so bad, so I'm not going to vote for Joe Biden, or I'm not going to vote for this person. Or if it was a Republican in the White House, inflation's so bad, I won't vote for, you know, President Romney or whoever. But what drives me nuts about this is there's not even a curiosity about how we are doing vis-a-vis, you know, global powers. Inflation's been bad in not just the United States. This isn't just something that one party or one person created. And it wasn't just created because, well, Biden's president, but Trump was president before, and did he lay the groundwork? There's a lot of powerful forces at work here. And I think James's email leads us to saying, maybe be curious. I don't know, Chuck.
Yeah, I mean, you know, there's like the saying, I think it's paraphrasing what Churchill was saying about, you know, democracy as a form of government is that, you know, we have the worst economy in the world in the United States, except for all the others.
That is Churchill. Good. It,
you know, and
well
it,
done,
it, but
Chuck.
It's true is that, you know, yeah, things are tough here, but man, you look around the world, it's a lot tougher in a lot of other economies. And we have a lot of tools here that I do believe can help us ride our way through those better than other countries around the world.
But to your point earlier, it's not sexy or exciting to say
no,
that.
No, it's not at all. But what it is helpful perspective, and I have yet to say that to somebody, and I have them say, no, that's not true. What it does is it helps them think, oh, yeah, good point, okay.
Okay. Eric?
Yeah, I mean, we look at this stuff really closely on an ongoing basis. You know, watching the inflation story in Britain, the UK ran into some serious trouble with their increasing of interest rates in order to handle their own inflation issues. You know, nearly breaking a sector of their financial system regarding pensions, which was really difficult. The European Union and the European Central Bank also increased rates in order to deal with inflation on their own. You know, these are other developed market areas that would be more commensurate with the U.S. and their democracy and their economy, although they are different and have certain limitations as well. But look at Argentina right now. I don't know if you've been following, but
Their recent election.
Election. They elected a guy by the name of Javier Milei, who himself an economist, and has some really interesting ideas about dollarization and, you know, eliminating the vast majority of government spending. You know, the reason why is because of rampant inflation. That's what's happening right now in Argentina.
His election was kind of a collective social revolt against inflation.
Exactly, exactly.
And it's going to be a grand experiment. We'll see what happens.
It will. They do have checks and balances. It will be interesting to see how Congress works with Javier Milei to the degree that they do. Again, something we watch. You know, we look at these global phenomenon right now, and it's you know, I appreciate James's question
there. Yeah, yeah, James, thank you for that email. And John in Rochester on the phone. Hi, John, go ahead.
When and where is it normal to have no inflation?
It's a good question, John.
So John, you know, it's inflation is actually a natural byproduct of a healthy growing economy. And, you know, we as a country and it's policymakers often use the sort of arbitrary amount of annual inflation. This is across all goods and services that are part of the consumer market basket of 2% year over year. And 2% is really sort of, I know it sounds like a lot, but it's kind of barely enough to feel. And as the economy grows over time, what happens is that people earn more money and they use that money to go out and buy more goods and services. And when they do that, they start bidding up the price of goods and services. And that actually, you know, that earning more money and buying more stuff so that more companies and independent businesses and corporations produce more is seen as a good thing. It helps, you know, create research and innovation and fund developments that way. And it helps improve quality of life for people. But there is this sort of tolerable yet annoying side effect of inflation that happens over time. So really 0% isn't the goal, because 0% isn't you know, it would sort of be like not having exhaust on your car. Well, that brings up the whole EV discussion. But let's talk about just like petroleum burning car. Like, you know, a car that's healthy and running well is going to create a certain amount of exhaust, which like we know isn't great. But if there's no exhaust coming out of the car, it's broken. Something's wrong, right? It's not moving. And if there's too much exhaust coming out of the car and it's billowing smoke, obviously something's wrong there too. This is a really rough analogy, but I hope it helps simplify. I hope it helps simplify why we look for a small amount of inflation over time. And really, the idea is that the standard of living outpaces inflation. And when inflation starts to get really high, that's the worry. It's not that, hey, prices are getting higher. It's that prices are getting higher and the standard of living isn't keeping up. That means people's pay isn't keeping up.
Last minute or so, Chuck, are your clients generally pretty even keeled? Do you get them there, and have you had to quell a lot of like concern in the last couple of years? Or do you? What's sort of the psychological moment that you're seeing?
Yeah, there's a lot of there has been a lot of what I'd call anxiety, which anxiety is fear plus uncertainty. It's fear of something happening and uncertainty, which is we don't know when it's going to end. And when you put those two together, it can be pretty troublesome. What my objective is to, you know, help you walk along the path and help us avoid turning that fear and uncertainty into regret, because we can't change that. That means we messed up and we can't fix it. And so, yeah, there is absolutely, and there should be, people would be crazy to not feel some of that. But I think we've been able to manage it fairly well by being, you know, upfront, realistic, and just helping people understand and speaking in ways that people can understand and digest that information and see how it appeals to them and impacts them in their own lives.
And oh man, I didn't have time to ask, what did you call it? The Magnificent Seven?
Yeah, the Magnificent Seven. Next time. We'll see if they're still magnificent then.
What's the hot stock that you all talked about?
Nvidia.
Nvidia?
That's one of them.
Yeah, chip maker, you know.
What's it going to do in 2024?
This is not a stock tip.
No,
by the way.
I know. That's why I'm joking. Like, oh, what's
if
it
you heard
do?
It here, it's too late.
Yeah, yeah, it's exactly right. Oh man, I've really appreciated this as always, helping contextualize and frankly taking some of the hype and just putting more of a sober, calm perspective on looking at the economy. That's good for all of us. That's why we call on people like Eric Morris, staff economist for Alesco Advisors. Thank you as always.
Thanks, Evan.
And that's why we call on Chuck Wade, Senior Vice President of Brighton Securities. Thank you, sir.
Thank you.
And happy new babyhood, sir.
Thank you, Evan.
Tommy's
doing great.
I hope you sleep a little bit. From the whole team at Connections, Julie, Evan, Megan, Rob saying thanks for listening. We're back with you tomorrow on member-supported public radio.